Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, happy Tuesday, August 12th. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. In the third hour of our program today, 3 hours hence, Larry Pratt, the executive director of Gun Owners of America, is going to be on. We're going to be discussing whether college students should be carrying guns and how this is going to play out in the presidential election, this whole issue of gun ownership, particularly in light of the recent Supreme Court decision. In our second hour, I want to get into the, first of all, give you just a quick heads up on what's going on with Liz Smith's column today and about a book that Lamar Waldron and I have coming out this fall and Who Killed Martin Luther King, as well as what did George Bush reveal that I don't think anybody has picked up yesterday in his press conference about possible U.S. complicity in what's going on in Georgia. And so, you know, we'll be getting into that as well. There's oil is in the news in a big way, and certainly the oil pipeline in Georgia, in the opinion of most, is figuring big into this whole thing between between Russia and Georgia and the United States and NATO and the whole thing. And at the same time, ExxonMobil has just reported the largest profit in the history of the world for any company anywhere ever, even back to the days of the Roman Empire. And there have been some attempts to, let's say, reconfigure how that profit may be distributed or how it may be acquired. George Landreth is with us. He's the president of Frontiers of Freedom, FF.org, a conservative think tank. George, welcome to the show.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
Thank you. The Republicans filibustered a bill back in July, or in June, actually. Harry Reid stood up and said, Republicans have a simple choice. Will they continue to stand with Bush and Cheney and the modern-day oil barons, or will they join us on the side of struggling American families who deserve better? This was the Consumer First Energy Act. It actually got more than 50 votes, you know, enough to pass, but not enough to stop the Republicans from saying that they were going to continue the debate. It would have created a 25% windfall profits tax on companies that don't invest in renewable fuels or electricity production, and it would zero out $17 billion in tax breaks and gifts that we are currently giving the oil industry and use that money to help consumers by investing in an energy independence and security trust fund that could be used for things like winterization and general energy savings. What's wrong with that, George?
Well, I think the windfall profit tax is basically a bad idea for a couple of reasons. When my daughter is a senior in high school, and when that was first floated, it was kind of floated as a response to high oil prices. You know, oil prices are high. Let's consider this windfall profit tax. And so we had a little party at our house for her graduation. Friends came over. So I just did a little check to see what high school students would think and how smart they were kind of on Econ 101. And I asked them, if oil companies have a windfall profit tax imposed on them, will that raise prices at the pump, lower prices at the pump, or keep them about the same? Fairly fair question. And every one of them got the answer right, which was it would be passed on to consumers and it would raise the price of the pump. So when you propose something as a solution to a problem, it ought not make the problem worse. And I think, one, that's clearly going to do that.
But I think you're mischaracterizing this proposed windfall profits tax. In fact, I would argue that that was a bad choice of language for the tax, because basically what this Consumer First Energy Act said, the one that actually got more than 51 votes in the Senate, but the Republicans still blocked from passage, was it said that if companies we're investing in renewable fuels and energy production from sun, solar, geothermal, things like that, that there would be no tax.
Right.
You and I both know, as I'm assuming that you had, at least at some point in your career and probably now are a small businessman, I certainly am. You remember the 2 and 3 martini lunch debates back in the 70s?
Right.
The government constantly, through our tax code, moves the behavior of corporations. There's a limit to how much, for example, if we're on a business trip, we can deduct for a meal. It's high enough that it keeps the restaurant business happy. It's low enough that you can't have a 3-martini lunch. There's a limit to how much a corporation can pay a CEO. They can't deduct more than $1 million from their taxes. And the goal is to try to reduce CEO pay. There's a thousand ways, probably 100,000 ways that we encourage or discourage specific behaviors. We give tax breaks to individuals to buy homes rather than to rent homes, because we think home ownership rather than home rental is a social good. This is simply another way of saying to the oil companies, that's fine, you're going to be oil companies, it's fine, you're going to make billions of dollars, but by the way, if you make that money in a way that is socially appropriate and is planning for the future and is in the best interest of this nation, you can continue to take those profits and put them in your pocket. But if you choose not to, if you choose to continue behaving in a way that ultimately is going to screw this country, we're going to tax you.
Well, I think that assumes that we know what's going to screw this country. I think given the fact that we've spent 30 years not drilling for oil in the U.S., you can make a pretty cogent argument that right now the most effective thing to do would be to fund more drilling and not spend more time funding ethanol. We funded ethanol like crazy of late, and it hasn't worked out real well for us or around the world. So my point, I guess, is it's not clear to me Congress knows what's best, and that's a hard argument to make, I think.
Wait a second. First of all, we spent 30 years not drilling. We have been pumping oil in the United States like crazy.
For 30 years, we've been cordoning off major areas of the United States where you can't drill.
There are over 10,000 leases in 68 million acres of public land that the oil companies have already determined where there is oil. They don't go to the expense of actually acquiring the lease until they know that there's oil. And they have chosen not to drill there. Exxon last year spent $7 billion finding and producing oil fields,
right.
A tiny fraction of their total revenue, which is over $100 billion, and most of that was outside the United States. Why? Because they've got the leases inside the United States already. They're sitting on them, waiting for oil to go to $200 a barrel.
No, I don't think they're waiting for it to go to $200 a barrel. The truth is they are driven by the same incentives as anybody else is, and so they're not going to put lots of money to drilling in areas where there is not oil. The way the oil leases are designed is they're relatively...
Then let them give back those leases, just like the coal companies have to.
I'm sorry?
In the coal business, if you get a lease on coal land and you don't use that within 2 years, you have to give it back. In oil, you can sit on it forever. Peter DeFazio has introduced legislation saying to the oil companies, use it or lose it. Very simply, if you've got a lease on some land and you've done the sounding and everything and you know where the oil is and you choose not to drill there because you just want to keep that on your books as an asset, and Exxon does have hundreds of millions of barrels of oil in the United States that have no wells on top of them yet, but they've found the oil there as assets on their balance sheet, which increases the value of the company. If you're going to do that, then after a couple of years, if you don't drill that oil, you lose that lease. And they're fighting, and the oil companies are fighting this tooth and nail, which belies what you just said.
Well, no, I don't think it does, because I think, the truth is there are oil wells in the U.S. today that are not currently productive, but if prices went up, they would be productive because the cost of extracting oil in some areas is more because it's, for example...
Sure, because we're past peak oil here in the U.S.
Well, in some areas, but the bottom line is...
Well, overall, too.
But the bottom line is, I think that the idea that... that Nancy Pelosi knows where to find the oil, and the idea that where she says there is oil is likely to be more accurate than where people who actually drill for oil.
No, I'm talking about the 10,000 leases that the companies that actually drill for oil found the oil and went to the government and said, we will pay you for a lease to have this oil.
Right.
And the government says, okay, fine, you can have that oil. And then they say, oh, by the way, we're not going to drill there right now. And which none of which addresses the issue of this so-called proposed windfall profits tax, saying if you invest in renewable energy, then you can keep your profits.
Right. Well, again, I think I'd like to see them invest in energy that will work and that will be less expensive and that will actually...
Right, like solar and wind.
Well, right now the evidence is that solar and wind are niche markets and they help in some ways, but that we're not going to be able to power our economy on them. And so
tell that to T. Boone Pickens.
Pardon me?
Tell that to T. Boone Pickens.
Well, I mean, I have told that to T. Boone Pickens. One of the problems I see is that when he talks about wind, wind doesn't blow sometimes. So you have to have a backup mechanism. And as soon as you have a backup mechanism, then what you're saying is we're going to have two power generation plants, one that will work when there's wind and one that will have to work when there's
not. Well, no, that's why you have a grid, a multifactorial grid.
I understand that. And our grid is currently is not able to handle the sorts of things that we're talking about.
So let's build out some infrastructure here.
I'm all for that. That's not a problem.
So you're in favor of a socialist program to do that?
Well, I think, to me, a grid is very much like a highway system. And so it's a
so it should be a public utility. It should be publicly owned. It should be socialized.
Well, I don't know that I would call it socialized. I think the bottom line is we do need a grid. It's very much like the highway. I guess you could call the highway socialized, but to me...
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay. That's not really how I view it. But
you can read all about it over Frontiers of Freedom, FF.org. George Lander, thanks for dropping by, George. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Change. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. John McCain is continuing his job-killing tour in Pennsylvania. Newt Gingrich is running around with his drill here, drill now, cheap gas shtick. Well, yeah, drill here, drill now. We've got 10,000 leases that the oil companies are sitting on 68 million acres of U.S. land already. And they're just, you know, keeping this stuff as an asset on their balance sheet. No need to drill this stuff. It's not necessary. You know, we could just jack our stock price up with it. And when the price of oil goes up a little more in a little more solid way, then we'll think about drilling it. Yeah. Yeah, we have a long history in the United States of using tax policies for what could arguably be called social good. Now, the $18 billion in tax breaks that we're giving the oil companies, I'm not sure that you'd call that a social good. It's certainly contributed $18 billion to their bottom line. And there's just, you know, this whole variety of just huge and bizarre profits that they're getting. Is that, you know, is that really the kind of market that we want to have? I mean, here, this is, well, and in fact, I would say that even the bigger problem with ExxonMobil is not, you know, oh, gee, they only made 7% or, you know, their return on investment, whatever. It's that they're so huge that we have so many very, very, very large oil companies. This is, you know, John Rockefeller's dream revisited, and they're, you know, effectively keeping out competition, fighting back competition, and they've become a force. They've become so large that they're a force that can be the tail that wags the dog of government. So instead of they're getting $18 billion in tax breaks, let's say that they simply kept the $18 billion in tax breaks that they're getting. But we said, instead of getting those $18 billion in tax breaks for basically doing nothing or for drilling for more oil, because most of them are tied to that. You know, the depletion allowances, the oil wells go down, we compensate them, we give them deductions on drilling equipment, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of all that, we say, you know, yeah, you can have $18 billion in tax breaks if you take that $18 billion and put it into solar and put it into wind and put it into geothermal. I'm guessing that at a certain point they're going to have to move in that direction anyway. But British Petroleum is now one of the largest solar companies in the world. They have figured out that they're in the energy business. Chevron is talking about this in their advertisements. ExxonMobil seems not to be. They seem to be totally wedded to the oil business. It reminds me of Western Union. Western Union, back in the late 19th century, was at the top of their game. I mean, everybody sent messages by telegraph. Go to your local Western Union office if you want to send it a message. You know, the equivalent of contracts, that business deals were cut, families kept in touch. I mean, this is before telephones, right? And Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, and he goes to Western Union and he says, I got this great idea. You already have wires all over America, and I have a system whereby those wires can be used to transmit a voice rather than da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, rather than Morse code. So let's convert your telegraph wires, or at least some of them, into telephone wires. And Western Union said, nice invention, Mr. Graham, but we're in the telegraph business. We're making a fortune in the telegraph business. Why should we invest in your telephone? And so Bell went off, and it took several more years as a result of this. You know, things were delayed considerably, and eventually AT&T, it was the precursor of AT&T. And who got left in the dust? Western Union. I mean, they're still around, but they're nothing compared to the big baby Bells. There was another story like that about the railroads. The railroads were these huge, multi-billion-dollar enterprises in the United States. I mean, they were the robber barons. You know, Jay Gould and all these guys, they're the major railroad barons. The biggest fortunes in America that were made in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s. In part because during the Civil War, Lincoln was shuffling hundreds of millions of dollars in today's dollars to the railroad barons, giving them free land, I mean, you know, building the railroad across to move around war material. And the Wright brothers invented this airplane, and they went to the railroads, and they said, you guys, you know, you're in the transportation business, and we've got a new transportation device. It's called the airplane. Why don't you start making airplanes, and let's build an industry here? And the railroads said, nah, we're in the railroad business. They never realized they were in the transportation business. And most all of those railroads now are long gone or just tiny shells of what they once were. And, in fact, none of them are carrying passengers. Only Amtrak is. It had to be reinvented as a government, federally chartered corporation, which is a fairly rare thing because they didn't get it. They didn't see the change coming. And I would say that the oil companies, the same thing is going on. We can push that change, particularly given things like global warming, you know, potential catastrophic disasters in the United States and around the world. We can push that change with simple things like tax policy, just like we changed the nature of business lunches. You know, watch Mad Men sometime. Back in the 60s, typical lunch, you know, four martinis and something fried, right? I mean, everybody was drunk at lunch. They said, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Let's scale back the 3-martini lunch, the 4-martini lunch to a 2-martini lunch. We legislate the behavior of corporations all the time. And very often, most often, it works to their benefit and to ours.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is light, crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attack the rack to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive. Take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it. We are just way too spoiled. Oh, yeah. Globe is heating up. You know it's starting to boil. Gonna have to face it. We're addicted to oil. I saw the signs, but I don't care. Ozone holes, polluted air. A hybrid car might save the day. Each time I look, I say no way, those cars look gay. I can't be saved, cause fossil fuels are what I crave. Without gas,
Ah, George, yeah. Well, speaking of the country being addicted to oil, maybe he's in the back room of the Oval Office IVing the stuff. I don't know. 35 minutes past the hour. Strange stuff going on out there in the world. Yes, a man claiming to be a police detective, saying he was with the age verification unit of the Longmont Police Department in Longmont, Colorado. Three different times he's tried this. Shows up at porn shops and says he's got to check out their X-rated videos to make sure there are no underage performers in them. Please give me all of those videos. And so they say, no, sorry. Third time they actually even called the cops on him. Although one of the porn shop purveyors said, well, it was an inventive idea, you know, but a little bizarre. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, thanks. Yeah, quick question about all this, you know, approach that, well, what we need to do is more drilling, et cetera, right now. Mm. Just, I know it's supposed to be the stereotype that liberals are the idealists and the conservatives are the hard-minded economic thinkers, but somebody please explain to me. Right now, oil companies have maximum demand. The demand may be even declining with Americans driving less. Their product is at maximum profitability right now. What exactly is their economic incentive once they're given exclusive oil leases that don't require them to do anything? What exactly is their business incentive to now increase costs and decrease the profitability of their product by producing more?
There is none. There is none. Zero. Okay. You're absolutely right. And that's my point is if we want to provide them with an incentive, the only tool that we have, particularly since we're dealing with monopolies here, is tax policy.
That's exactly right. And also, the Secretary of the Interior already has the authority to get on the backs of oil companies and take back their leases or do fines and stuff. But I don't think I've seen any evidence that any kind of enforcement making companies produce on the exclusive leases ever again. I think there's been nothing and no
administration.
I doubt that there would be.
Yeah, our president is an oil man. Our vice president is an oil man. Our president's father was an oil man, although it was a CIA front to spy on Cuba, but nonetheless.
So if we give them these exclusive leases, all we'll have done is protect them to keep their maximized profitability product exclusive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Dan and Gaylord. Hey, Dan. Gaylord, Michigan.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to bring up a point that I've been trying to make with people when they say stuff about, oh, the tax increase is just going to be passed along to the consumer. Well, to me, that's a tacit admission that the market that they're operating in is not a free one, because in a free market with robust competition, a savvy business would absorb the tax increase to keep their product price low, so they can gain more market share.
Right. What they would do is they tighten their belt. They would either tighten their belt internally with regard to the company, or they decrease the dividends, perhaps decrease the $400 million paychecks that they give to their CEOs when they leave the job. Absolutely right. It is an admission. It's an absolute admission of monopoly. And the fact that all of this guy's teenage kids didn't realize that is a really sad commentary on the nature of economic wisdom or knowledge of kids coming out of our public school system. Excellent point, Dan. Thank you for making it. Very well said. Scott in Houston, Texas. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Best show on Sirius. Whatever they're paying you, it's not enough, man.
Yeah, thank you. They're paying me nothing. It's a barter thing. We're all supported by our advertisers, so support our advertisers, please.
You can only go up from here then, right?
Thank you.
Hey,
indeed.
I just want to make a quick point. I build and remodel houses here in Houston, Texas. You know, I get so tired of hearing from Republicans that wind power, solar power, it's not efficient. There's, you know, we have to drill our way out of this.
Yeah.
Number one, you can't drill your way out of it. The analogy I tell people, it's like if you have a bathtub, you're filling with water, it's got a huge crack in it. Their solution is to keep pouring water in it, whereas the Democrats want to fix the crack. They want to stop the crack. They want to stop the hemorrhaging.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor.
There are so many ways. I'm lucky. The part of town I work in is pretty progressive. So many ways you can, to an existing house or even new construction, make them much more energy efficient, at least about 20% off their utility bills.
Oh, it was amazing. Back when I lived in Vermont, one of my best friends, Hal Cohen, was the head of the Central Vermont Community Action Program. He still is, actually. And they had this, they got a grant, and they put together this program where they would go out, they had this machine that would just, like, look at your house in ultraviolet, or infrared, rather,
Right.
And you know, just a 5 minute, you know, glimpse of the house from a couple of different angles, they could spot all the places where heat was leaking. You know, you go out on a cold day and you just see the heat. And just by, you know, weather stripping and in some cases replacing windows, blowing in a little insulation here and there. I mean, fixes that would cost in some cases as little as $100. In some cases, you know, on the high end, maybe $1,000 would save people thousands of dollars over the next couple of years in their energy costs. I mean,
absolutely true. I'm working on right now. I'm working on a 7,200 square foot house. We blew R30 in the attics. We're only required to do R19, but the couple's very energy conscious. They're socially conscious. I think it added $200 to their overall insulation bill. The overall insulation bill was like $2,000. This came up to $2,200.
Right.
It's going to pay itself off in 2 months, literally, and two
yep.
months of cooling.
Yep.
So, I mean, and you could expand on that. The government, you know, with air conditioning systems, we mostly put in R13 SEER units.
Mm-hmm.
If they gave a credit, say they gave a $2,000 credit to everyone, I can guarantee you I could sell R18 units to, or 18 SEER units to everyone whose house I work on. I mean, it would not require that much money.
Right.
And the savings would be phenomenal.
Yeah, the one other thing that we could do, Scott, is we could legislatively, I'd love Congress to do something like this. I think that there aren't enough people in Congress who understand, you know, electronics and technology. But if we simply outlawed parasitic power supplies and said every device, rather than having a little transformer that plugs into the wall and continuously draws power even when the device isn't being used, every device has to have an on-off switch on it, and when it's turned off, it's actually turned off. All over the UK, for example, every electrical outlet has an on-off switch at the outlet, right at the outlet. But if you say every device, you can't have these parasitic power supplies anymore, because they account for somewhere between 7 and 10% of all the electricity used in the United States is being used by things that are not even turned on.
Yeah, right.
And that very much was not the case 30 years ago.
Yeah, and like usual, especially with the Bush administration, instead of our country leading, you look at countries like Iceland, they're going to be totally off fossil fuels in another 30 years. Ireland, you know, countries that are using a wave power generation. We have this huge opportunity to lead and help the planet and help our country. And like usual, the Republicans are sitting there with their thumbs in their butts, you know?
Yeah, they're fiddling while Rome burns. Pick your cliche of choice, but yeah, absolutely. Scott, thank you very much. Sanchez in Montebello, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Sanchez.
The best possible good morning to you, sir.
Thank you, and vice versa.
Thank you, sir. I can't help but notice, I know that you were about to discuss the complicity of the Americans concerning the Georgian-Russian war that's going on.
Yeah, I want to get into that and oil in the next hour. Yeah.
Yes. Isn't it amazing, first of all, how oil has become such a four-letter word? And the issue over the pipeline, the issue is all about oil here. Georgia is hosting a pipeline which starts at the Caspian Sea oil sources and runs through and bypasses Russia, runs through Georgia as well as several other countries, including Turkey, and winds up in the Mediterranean. One of the main issues here, a secondary issue, is the complicity of Israel. They have been training the Georgian troops. There's been at least 1,000, I don't want to say mercenaries, but professional soldiers have been in Georgia training their soldiers for, as
we've
they call it,
been training,
purposes.
Sanchez, we have been training the Georgian troops as
yeah.
well. I mean, this is the thing. This is where I think that George W. Bush laid. In fact, I was going to wait until the next hour to really get into this. But let me just share this right here and right now. This George Bush, his press conference yesterday, he's going off on this. And he made an interesting comment.
I am deeply concerned by reports that Russian troops have moved beyond the zone of conflict, attacked the Georgian town of Goree, and are threatening the Georgia's capital of Tbilisi. There's evidence that Russian forces may soon begin bombing the civilian airport in the capital city. These reports are accurate. These Russian actions would represent a dramatic and brutal escalation of the conflict in Georgia.
Now listen.
These actions would be inconsistent with assurances we have received from Russia that its objectives were limited to restoring the status quo in South Ossetia that existed before fighting began on August the 6th.
Now, that I find very interesting. And by the way, at that point, he's pulling his ear like he does when he's, lying or something. And so he received assurances. We were, like, notified in advance the Russians were going to do this. or we helped the Georgians do the first invasion of South Ossetia, and then we were assured that the Russia. I mean, was this something that was orchestrated between us and the United States? Bush talking about assurances? 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Before the hour, just a quick heads up, this weekend the Seattle gig is totally sold out, by the way. We'll be there, looking forward to that. KPTK AM 1090 AM, I think it's 1,000 seats were sold, and they're gone, those tickets. I'll be at Radio Row at both the Democratic and Republican conventions in Denver on August 26th at 6 p.m., and let's see, what day of the week is that? August 26th is a Tuesday. So Tuesday night, August 26th in Denver, I will be doing a talk and book signing at Borders Books in Lone Tree, Colorado, in the Park Meadows Mall. And there's more information about that on AM 760 Colorado's Progressive Talks website, which is am760.net. And then on September 2nd, which is also a Tuesday, the AM 950, the voice of Minnesota, KTNF, where we're also on the air, invites you to a party for a change. Join Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, Jim Ward, Chris Lavoie, Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, and John Elliott. And Bill Press and I will be doing book signings. Doors open at 5:30. Party runs until 9:30. It's at the Black Bear Crossing in the lake, located in the historic Como Lakeside Pavilion. You can get more information at the Voice of Minnesota's website, am950ktnf.com. So check that out. And congratulations, catching people's doing something right. Coyote Woman says, hey, today I volunteered my services to our County Elections Commission, having listened to your exhortations. I will happily sit with the ballot box on Election Day or merely bring coffee and donuts, but I think I may actually have a chance to be part of processing the ballots. And I was pleased to inform the county elections clerk that it was the Tom Hartman program it's Tom Hartman who urged me to volunteer, and that she could listen to Tom herself on our local station, KBBR, once that bastion of country western music and conservative political thought, which now broadcasts Air America instead. Well, good on you. Congratulations. I think that's absolutely wonderful. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And I have a call from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I don't see a name here. I'm sorry. Listening to WLBY. What's your name?
Ed.
Ed. Hey, Ed, you're on the air. What's up?
All right, Tom. First of all, I love your show. You do just a fantastic job. Been interested in the coverage on Georgia, and I wanted to add some stuff. I think in addition to oil, which the oil competition is obvious, but the other thing to be considered is some stuff that happened in the 90s, and the first thing was broken U.S. promises to Russia regarding NATO expansion into former Warsaw Pact countries. Also, the Kosovo War was a big issue for them because NATO was used defensively with no U.N. resolution, and that alarmed both Russia and China.
Right, and they argued, actually, NATO was used offensively because NATO
exactly
wasn't under attack. I mean, our argument was we were trying to stop a genocide, but still.
Yep. So, yeah, right. There's reasons you can argue for the intervention, but there are also reasons that it disturbed Russia and China.
Yeah.
And the other thing that people really should know about is the whole, I guess, Jeffrey Sachs, Friedmanite, neoliberal shock therapy that was done under Yeltsin, which was really just the same sort of forced privatization that took place in Chile. And you've discussed that too, but remember that happened in Russia in the 90s. It was an attempt to privatize do it fast,
right,
so that people couldn't react to it. And that really impoverished Russia. All the state assets, the oil companies were sold off.
It devastated the nation and created an oligarchy. And the Chinese have looked at that and said, okay, we're not going to go down that road.
Exactly. A big failure. And that makes them not want to pursue any of the stuff that we're dishing out. So people should know about all those things. It's oil, but it's also that stuff, too. It was neoliberalism, the Friedmanite stuff was a big issue in the 90s.
Yep.
And that taught them that they can't trust us,
yes,
that America is not acting in good faith. And a lot of what Yeltsin is doing, it looks in some ways undemocratic, although we should remember that that guy is very, very popular in Russia.
Are you talking about Putin and Medvedev?
Putin for sure,
yeah,
is
yeah,
popular because...
Yeah. No, I actually have friends in Russia. I mean, I helped start a program in Russia through Salem International and spent a fair amount of time in Kaliningrad. And I was just talking with one of those friends in email a couple of days ago. And yes, Putin is incredibly popular because he's a nationalist and he appeals to Russian nationalism and they all view him as a patriot. And also because he's taken on the oligarchs and is talking about, you know, let's do social programs in Russia and let's, you know, bring back social programs. Ed, I got to move along, but your point is well made and well said. Thank you very much. Gary in Indiana. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, great program. I just wanted to make a few points. First of all, any addict, when you take away his drug, the first thing he does is scream for more of it.
Yep.
And it sounds so much like the drillers today.
Yep.
And I wanted to make some basic comments. I mean, elementary price theory will tell you if you add supply and the price doesn't change much, I mean, we don't have a supply problem today. There are no gas lines. The supply is adequate to the demand, and the demand is fairly stable.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, more oil is not going to be the answer to this. What's going to make the demand more elastic is an alternative choice.
It's conservation. Although, let's keep in mind that the oil market is not anything close to a free market, even a Friedman-type free market, because most of the oil in the world is controlled by state oil companies who are members of OPEC, who are, you know, amping up or cutting back on their distribution of oil, on the amount of oil that they're putting into world markets as a way of manipulating oil prices. So,
oh, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
But the biggest point that you make, which I think is spot on, Gary, is that addicts, when they're deprived of the drug of choice, start screaming for more. That's their first response, rather than looking for solutions. And that's the Republican Party. I mean, these Republicans who are doing this stunt of call back Congress, you know, and all this kind of stuff, you know, Gingrich and all these guys, they need to be called addicts. I mean, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi should be calling them out on it. Addicts!
This is Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Just to wrap up some of our conversation of the last hour about the oil companies and taxes and all this kind of stuff. These are the subsidies and giveaways that are currently in place for the oil companies as a result of the Bush-Cheney energy policy, which came out of Cheney's private meetings with Ken Lay and the head of ExxonMobil and the head of Chevron back in 2001. The oil and gas depletion allowance, $5.9 billion. The manufacturing tax deduction for oil, $5.1 billion. This is over a five-year period. These are the tax subsidies that you and I are giving to the oil companies right now. Royalty holidays, $3.8 billion. Royalties are, you know, like when they get leases and they pay royalties, and we'll give them $3.8 billion. Research and development subsidies, $1.6 billion. Small refineries deduction, $100 million, exemption from bond arbitrage rules, $18 million, and big oil's share of John McCain's proposed corporate tax cut, $22 billion. Now, that amount of money could weatherize 14 million American homes, dramatically reducing the amount of oil we're using. It could produce enough high-quality wind power plants to power approximately 6 million homes and create 46,000 high-quality jobs in the process. And it could be invested in enough geothermal power plants, pulling heat out of the soil, out of the earth, deep earth, to power 9.7 million American homes, creating 120,000 jobs in the process. But no, we're not going to do that. There's a new age of authoritarianism. Krista Freeland is writing about this in today's Financial Times, and this ties in with what's happening in Georgia. It ties in with what's happening with the oil, the whole situation with oil around the world. I've noticed also that gold has been falling through the floor. I am guessing, and this is just a wild guess. I base this on no inside information. I haven't even been reading the gold bulletin boards and whatnot recently. I've just been too busy. But wouldn't surprise me at all if Russia is selling gold like crazy right now in anticipation of this conflict. But nonetheless, Krista Freeland is talking about how the new form of government that is emerging in the world is authoritarian. And she doesn't use the F word here, fascist, but I was talking about this a week or so ago, and she is saying the same thing in today's editorial page in the Financial Times. She talks about how George W. Bush, U.S. president, says on his Asia tour, young people who grow up with the freedom to trade goods will ultimately demand the freedom to trade ideas. Well, no. She points out that the Chinese are taking a different view, and the new Russians are taking a different view of this, and as she says, acting on it. David Shambaugh is a Chinese scholar, and he's got a new book out called Chinese Communist Party, Atrophy and Adaptation. And as Krista Freeland points out, he says, rather than seeing it as proof of the inevitable, this is the Communist Party of China looking at the Soviet collapse and their brief experimentation with neoliberalism, Milton Friedman, free marketism, and then they're seeing oligarchies rise, poverty explode, and now they're backing away from all that. Rather than seeing it as proof of the inevitable global triumph of Western liberalism, the Chinese comrades treated the Russian example as a textbook case of what a ruling Communist Party ought not to do. And in fact, they see Tiananmen Square as a high point, the Chinese do. This was when they really clamped down. Now consider, why do governments murder their own people? Why do they wiretap people? Why do they torture people? It's not so much for the end. Why do they allow it to be publicized? Why does it work to the benefit, at least in their minds, of Bush and Cheney and company to say, one, yes, we will torture people. Yes, we will hold people indefinitely. Yes, we will export people to be tortured, that all this kind of stuff. And at the same time, things like Mukasey now coming out and saying, no, we're not going to prosecute any of these people who actually broke the law. And this is an actual quote today. Mukasey gave a speech, the Attorney General of the United States, looking at the people within the Justice Department who committed criminal acts, by saying that they would not hire civil servants if they had any liberal ties. These are not political positions. These were positions where the main criteria should have been competence. Mukasey said before the American Bar Association, and I'm just astounded that the story doesn't go on to point out how many people stood up and barfed when he said it. He said, but not every wrong or even every violation of the law is a crime. Say what? Say what? Not every violation of the law is a crime? What am I missing here? Well, here's the point. And by the way, these were determined by the Inspector General and the Office of Professional Responsibility, this is Michael Elston, that these people who Mukasey says he's not going to prosecute, quoted, quote, violated federal law by selecting candidates based on their own political affiliations. So anyhow, why is the Bush administration going down the same road that the communists in Russia and that the communists in China are doing, or the former communists in Russia, and the pseudo-communists, basically the fascists in Russia and the fascists in China are doing? And it's because it is an instrument of intimidation. It's a way of keeping the people down. Why does the Bush administration actually not mind that it's known that they will torture people? Because they want you and I to think, you know, if we speak out too much, we might get tortured. Why is it that George Bush is bragging about the fact that he broke the FISA law, could have been imprisoned for centuries, bragging about it? Because he wants the Democrats to be afraid that he's listening into their conversations. He wants you and I to be afraid that they may be listening into our conversations or reading our email or checking the websites we're going to. That's how authoritarian regimes work. That's how they maintain power. They maintain power by using small, individual, specific acts that are well publicized by a compliant media as a way of subtly scaring the people. And then you don't need to have huge, massive acts. Tiananmen Square was a high point for China. And Krista Freeland, pointing this out in today's Financial Times, she quotes she says, after 89, after Tiananmen Square, she's quoting Sinologist Andrew Nathan, this guy who's a student of China. And he says, as a propaganda position, they've put it out that we have a crackdown in 89. We saved the party. We saved the country. We don't have a failure of will like the Russians. And without that, we wouldn't have been a great modern power. And that, by the way, has now become Vladimir Putin's point of view and Medvedev's point of view. Which is why they, when Shakaavili, the president of Georgia, invaded this one of these breakaway republics in the north, and apparently this is an invasion that was encouraged by the United States, which might be why Putin, one of the reasons why Putin told Bush where he could put it when they were in China, that Russia reacted so heavily, so strongly, so violently, and didn't just take back that territory, but drove all the way into Georgian territory itself, was because they're saying to every other republic, this isn't about taking Georgia and taking the pipeline. I mean, that's a bonus if they do. Frankly, I don't think that they're going to take Georgia. I think that they've decided to back off, and they're just going to reassert the independence of these two breakaway republics. But what they're saying to the other countries in the region, to all the various stands, any country that's thinking of joining NATO, any country that's thinking of getting embedded with the United States and doing as Shakaavili did and following our advice and taking our lead and taking our training and building their military with U.S. help and U.S. allies, in this case some Israeli help as well, what Putin is saying is, don't even consider it. We will crush you. And the people of those countries have to be looking at this and going, okay, which do we want? Peace? And not a lot of political freedom, but peace? Or political freedom and bombs falling on our heads all the time? And typically people will choose the former over the latter if those are the only two choices they have.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I love it here. Chet sends me an email and his signature. He says, three contractors who were bidding for a small White House job. The Democrat bid $900. He says $400 for material, $400 for my crew, $100 profit for me. The independent bid $700. $300 materials, $300 for the crew, and $100 for his company. The Bushy contractor bid $2,700 and explained it this way. That's $1,000 for you, $1,000 for me, and we'll hire the independent for $700. Yeah. That's what's going on in Iraq. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. By the way, I wanted to mention today's New York Post. Liz Smith, in her column, is talking about Lamar Waldron and I have a book coming out in November. And Lamar is the lead author in this. It's Lamar Waldron with Tom Hartman, just like our book on the JFK assassination, Ultimate Sacrifice. This is the sequel to it. It's called Legacy of Secrecy. And in that book, we lay out who killed Martin Luther King and how it got covered up and why. And, you know, Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana and the whole mob thing, Marcello and Trafficante. Do you know that James Earl Ray had, when he was caught finally, in his possession, a map which included a Johnny Roselli's home in Los Angeles? So anyhow, this was a hit that was hired through Marcello and Trafficante, and Roselli by four racists in Georgia. And we name them in the book. We lay the whole thing out. But Liz Smith did a really nice piece on it today. And you can check it out over at the New York Post's website. Or if you get the web, or if you get the post, you can just read Liz Smith's column. I wanted to just wrap up this one other point here, though, about totalitarianism. The other point Chrystia Freeland makes in the Financial Times this morning. She talks about the reconstruction of a neo-authoritarian state in Russia as the way to restore Russia's greatness. And she says the West has been remarkably sanguine about this resurgence of authoritarianism, and one reason is that this time the comrades have money. I would submit to you that it actually goes a step beyond that. It's that we're seeing a resurgence of authoritarianism in the United States as well. Remember Ari Fleischer saying, you know, don't question the guy after 9/11, you know, don't question the government, don't question Bush. I mean, there has been this steady drumbeat from the Reich in this country of, you know, don't question Bush, get on the bandwagon, go along with the thing. In fact, she wraps this piece up. She says the 21st century's moneyed authoritarians, figuring out how to contain the 21st century's moneyed authoritarians, is our most pressing foreign policy dilemma. I would submit to you it is also our most pressing domestic policy agenda. We have multimillionaires and billionaires running this country by and large, both within and outside of government. And what they have figured out, after watching it being done in a brutal way, in Russia, Spain, and Italy, and in a subtle way, although still brutal, a far more subtle way in China and in the United States since 9/11, is and now in Russia under Putin and Medvedev, is that the subtle kind of authoritarianism, the step-by-step kind of authoritarianism. Boy, it's a strange noise going on, Sean, over here. I don't know what that is. If you can track it down, I'd appreciate it. That kind of authoritarianism is the stuff that's successful. It's the way you take a country down. It's what they're doing. They're basically taking a country down. They're taking the United States, taking down freedom. And we're seeing this with Mukasey. We're seeing it. This is the kind of thing that the Don Siegelman prosecution is all about. Here's Don Siegelman. He's a governor. This is the thing that the Paul Miner prosecution is all about. Here's the guy who's the largest political donor in the South, or in Alabama or Mississippi. I forget which of the two states it was. The largest political Democratic donor. A very, very successful Democratic trial lawyer. And because he's a source of money, the Republicans decide to take him out. And so the federal prosecutor goes after him on phony, trumped-up charges. The federal prosecutor goes after goes after Don Siegelman on phony trumped up charges. Why? Because he's a Democrat who's popular in Alabama. He's a Democrat who's actually winning elections. He's a Democrat who's holding Republicans to account. And so they trump up these phony charges and go after. By the way, I once again encourage you to go to Don Siegelman, I before E, donsiegelman.com or .org. He's got both of them. And toss a small contribution his way, or even a large one if you can afford it, to help him in his legal battle. Because this, I'm telling you, this is the guy that is going to reveal. This is the case that is going to reveal how criminally corrupt, and not just criminally corrupt, authoritarian, fascistic, the Bush administration has become. They won't prosecute criminals within the administration. They won't prosecute Republicans. You know, David Vitter gets busted with a prostitute. Any talk about that being a crime? Not only is there no talk about it being a crime, he gets a standing ovation when he comes back into the Senate. You know, one of the reasons why I'm not even going to discuss John Edwards, I mean, let's look at what the Republicans are doing. This is just, but the whole point here is the Republicans will not prosecute Republicans, and they go on vigilante crusades against Democrats.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, it's definitely time to throw the rascals. We've all had enough. And have you had enough of the economy going so far south that even people who are employed...
Better take off your coat.
Even people who are employed...
Real slow.
Need to use the sink at work...
Better take off your shoes.
To take a bath. Yeah, in fact, it happened in Xenia, Ohio.
Baby, take off your dress.
An employee working at the Burger King in Xenia, Ohio. Bathing in the sink. In fact, it's on YouTube. Isn't that sweet? Yeah, leave your hat on. Well, he didn't leave his hat on, so very strange stuff. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And, oh, by the way, speaking of congressmen caught with a prostitute, here's another one. This Representative Calvert, Ken Calvert, the congressman, the Republican from California. Vice President Cheney is going to be showing up at a fundraiser with him tomorrow. He's one of the 22 most corrupt members of Congress. He's made huge profits for himself and his personal firm off his own earmarks. He's rewarded K Street firms under federal investigation with pork projects. In July of 2007, a federal grand jury said the sale of 4 acres of public land to him and his investment partners in 2005 violated California state law. And he went to Saudi Arabia with Randy Duke Cunningham back in 2004. And in 1993, he was caught by police with a prostitute in a parked car in California, tried to drive away from the scene. "We were just talking, that's all," he told police, as he continued to cover his unzipped pants with his hand, according to a police report. Yep, that's the guy Dick Cheney's out there raising money for. Amazing. Mark in Laney, New Mexico. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, I've just got a couple of little tidbits for you. Speaking of prostitutes, did you know that Condoleezza Rice made a secret, unreported meeting with the president of Georgia 2 days before this war got started?
No, I didn't know that, but I did know that we have been advising them. We've been closely talking with them. And I played the clip earlier of Bush talking about the assurances that he had received before this thing started. And it's like, hey, wait a minute. Why isn't anybody following up on saying what assurances from whom? You know, it's just, but that wouldn't surprise me. As I said, I believe that this was part of a provocation that the neocons in this administration, and they may even be setting up an October surprise. They may even be looking for a confrontation with Russia in October that will take us, that'll be like a Bay of Pigs kind of, not Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis kind of thing, where, you know, it gets right up to the edge and then backs away, thinking that this is going to help McCain in the election. And who knows? It may not. Frankly, I think it may backfire. I think people will look at McCain and say, "Do we really want this guy with his finger on the trigger?" But nonetheless,
you're onto it, my friend.
I think that they're pushing a provocation.
The other tidbit is that Georgia is one of the few so-called coalition of the willing, and they used to have 2,000 troops.
Yeah, up until yesterday.
On the Iran-Iraq border, they were keeping the Iranians out of Iraq, and now they pulled back all of those troops to protect themselves against the Russians.
Right. They were the third largest supplier.
What kind of a hole does that leave?
Yeah, they were the third largest supplier of, thank you, Mark. They were the third largest supplier of troops to the coalition of the billing. And in exchange for that, we were giving them, you know, military support. We were building their army. We wanted to get them into NATO. Keep in mind, if they were in NATO, then what happened over the weekend would have been like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. You know, where you've got all these interlocking treaties, and an attack on one country is considered an attack on all of them. An attack on Georgia would have been an attack on the United States. We would have had to respond. We'd be in World War III right now, in my humble opinion. So this is just not a good thing, not a healthy thing. Robert in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Robert.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I think when 9/11 happened and they showed those planes going in so many times, I really believe what occurred is in many people, in many psyches that, you know, weren't, I don't know what the word is, together in their own mindset spiritually, created a mental disorder. There's a great book by Ernest Becker called The Denial of Death.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but you know, he explains that, you know, humans are just, they're after so much. They have so many expectations. And when that occurred, and when 9/11 occurred, I really, truly believe that from the government down, if you look, you know, you always spring up every day, you know, what is going on with these people? What is, you know, the government, why are we going authoritarianism? Why is that happening more and more? And you always bring up, you know, you're always concerned, like, what is the reason for the insanity? And I really believe that it is mental disorder. I think that if psychiatrists and scholars and that, I believe that you can bring it to light also, that is what occurred. If you look
I agree with you, Robert. And there's actually a name for it. It's post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly.
And it was induced by the media replaying, as you point out, over and over and over again, like on a loop for weeks, that video of those planes hitting the tower and people jumping out of the windows and people being terrified. And we all experienced it as intensely as did the people in New York City. And, you know, spot on. And all the more the disaster. But I would say that this isn't the only time that this has been used. Consider the Committee on the Present Danger. I mean, this is something that was put together back in the day. I mean, the second Committee on the Present Danger was put together in 1972, and you know, with help from Thomas Wolfe of the Rand Corporation and George Herbert Walker Bush, Gerald Ford. You know, this is Team B, this thing that was put together, and Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, some of these familiar names, right? And Jeannie Kirkpatrick, what they did is they came out and they said, this was in response to Richard Nixon coming back from a meeting with Khrushchev and saying and announcing detente. Nixon and Kissinger and Khrushchev and his side had negotiated, and this was also after Nixon had quote, opened up China. Nixon came back and he made this big speech. And I should track down the audio of it and share it with you one of these days. And Sean, let's put that on the list. He gave this speech where he said, the era of fear is over. He declared an end to the era of fear. And these guys said, no, we can't have that. We can't have that. So George Shultz and Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and Bill Casey and all these guys, they put together this thing called the Committee for the Present Danger Team B. In 76, Gerald Ford put that together. The Committee for the Present Danger started in 72. And they came out with a public announcement that, no, the Soviet Union is still a danger. In fact, they've got a new submarine that is so secret that the USA can't even detect it. And the CIA said, no, there's no such submarine. And they said, no, it's so secret, it's so silent, it uses a new technology, it can travel silently, so you can't even detect its presence, and it's radar invisible. And the CIA said, there's no such thing. The CIA actually held a public press conference to say, there's no such thing. And Rumsfeld says, see, that's proof that it's there. That's proof that it is so sophisticated that the CIA can't even find it. And there was this open question until the end of the Cold War, until the 90s, over whether Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and these guys were right or not back in the 70s when they said, you know, we have to be terrified. We have to spend more and more on military contractors who, by the way, were their buddies and, you know, were their investors and their supporters. And it turns out the Soviet Union had no such submarine. And so it's just the same thing all over again. It is disaster capitalism. I mean, Naomi Klein has written about it, you know, so brilliantly. So Daryl in Vancouver, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Daryl.
Hey, Tom. Appreciate your show. You're a real renaissance man. Anyway, the Financial Times article you're talking about, it kind of goes to what Naomi Wolf was talking about in her book, Letters to a Young Patriot.
Mm, yeah.
She made that point, you know, about the Bush regime, you know, telling us about the torture and letting.
Yeah, I think that's the subtitle. Isn't the title The End of America?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the subtitle of it. And the thing about it is, I was wondering, why would a feminist be writing this book, right? I mean, you know, she was the beauty myth and that sort of thing. And then come to look at it, I mean, it's almost like a recipe for battered wife syndrome and stuff on a national scale.
Yeah, it is. And Naomi Wolf has been on the show. When the book first came out, we had her on the program, and it's an absolutely chilling book. It's a small book. I think it's in the neighborhood of 100 pages. You can read it in an afternoon, and it's basically the 10 things that fascist governments always do when they prepare a nation for fascism, when they set up the takedown of democracy. And then she goes through and she shows how the Bush administration has done all 10 of these things. They've put all of these things in place. Several of them they actually implemented, and a few of them they've put them into place in ways that all they have to do is push a button or pull a lever, and boom, there it is. It's in place. And it's absolutely chilling reading, and it is, Daryl, as you point out, it's absolutely a brilliant read, Naomi Wolf's book, The End of America. And certainly something I encourage everybody to check out, along with Naomi Klein's, the two Naomis, Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, or The Shock Doctrine, rather, which is all about disaster capitalism, which is what we're seeing. And disaster capitalism, in my opinion, is just another way of saying fascism.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Now tell me the truth, is anything so uncouth? Could a person be more of a mess than to chatter and such and say stay in touch but don't have an email address?
Good Lord.
Now God clearly meant that an email be sent anytime that you have a thought. And if your inbox ain't scoured 5 or 6 times an hour, then you ain't doing all that you ought.
Sounds like my life.
How could I ever stay in touch without my ISP? To let my friends know I'm alive and to find out who loves me. I plumb forgot how to use the phone and the mail is way too slow. Do they have email in heaven? If not, I don't want to go.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner's with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
A real fast one here for you, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Condoleezza Rice just came out to the stakeout at the White House just a few minutes ago and said that she had just briefed the president. The G7 foreign ministers had a conference call this morning, and they say that France is apparently doing a lot of the work right now. They're negotiating between Georgia. They're also negotiating with Russia. But they're saying the fighting has got to stop. Well, okay.
But I'm sorry. The last couple of words you said got garbled, Ellen.
Sorry. The EU is saying the fighting has got to stop. Well, the fighting can stop. That's fine. But there is, it hasn't stopped. And, of course, Georgia wants a ceasefire. But
right.
The Russians apparently are not there, although they're saying there is a real problem with this. The Georgians want it to stop. The Russians don't. Everybody's saying that the Russians are not going to continue once they negotiate. Well, they're taking their time negotiating
right.
So that they can get what they want.
What do you think the chances are, Ellen, that the Russians are going to take Tbilisi, that they're going to literally, I understand that there was an assassination attempt against Shakhavili, the president of Georgia, that they're going to actually take down the government and replace it with a puppet government?
Apparently, they want, as we say in our business, regime change.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe they're just going to cause so much, they're going to inflict so much pain. Maybe the plan B to produce regime change would be similar to what we did in Iraq before we actually invaded, which is, create so much pain that you hope that the people will overthrow the existing government.
Right. And you hope that somehow they're going to know that the game is over and they're not going to fight you.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So that's sort of the sum total of our news on that front. Sorry there's not a little more today, but the White House canceled their briefing several times.
There seems to be a growing international...
There is not going to be a briefing, and all there was is Condoleezza Rice, and she didn't take questions.
Right. Ellen, there seems to be, from reading, like the Asia Times and the Jerusalem Post and some of the Der Spiegel, this morning, looking at and the Financial Times for that matter, there seems to be a growing international consensus that this really was started by the president of Georgia invading one of these two breakaway territories, but that he did that at the encouragement of the United States, of the Bush administration, and that both he and the Bush administration had wildly underestimated the ferocity of the Russian response.
For sure, and they also didn't think that the Russians were going to confront them on something that they felt sort of was their new democracy routine.
Right.
Because they thought, well, Russia is sort of a democracy. The old McDonald's theory of places with McDonald's don't fight each other. And that's just wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And there needs to be a new paradigm.
Well, Russia is not a democracy; it's an oligarchy. I mean, it's arguably to some extent, the United States is even moving in that direction. China certainly is. It's not communist anymore; it's fascist. I mean, and on it goes.
Well, yes. I mean,
excuse me.
I was in Russia with the Clinton administration agency for international development this summer after Clinton became president. So it was 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us on the old dog and pony show to show us the democracy, to show us how Russians were all given stock in their various former Soviet corporations.
Right.
And then we heard that the Italian mafia was so upset with the Russian mafia, they thought that they were so ruthless that they would have nothing to do with them.
Right. Right. And it's true to this day. I mean, it's true. We saw the Russian mafia up close and personal, both in Russia and in Croatia. And I'm telling you, these people take no prisoners.
Absolutely
and they're quite,
not.
And they strut around like Al Capone in his high times.
Yes. And I actually think, you know, a lot of the analysis in the Washington newspapers today is that the Russian crisis benefits McCain. I don't actually see that it does, because I think that Bush looks very far out there, and all they need to do is start running those ads, which I don't think the Democrats will ever do, about how he looked in Putin's eyes and trusted the guy.
Yeah. Well,
but
the for
Democrats
that matter,
have no guts.
You know, yeah, and what I thought was interesting was, you know, Barack Obama's response to this was the entirely appropriate one, which was, you know, let's get in there, let's negotiate, let's mediate this thing, let's stop it, let's have a, you know, let's bring all parties to the table, let's stop the hostilities. McCain's response was, let's threaten Russia with an empty threat. I mean, what are we going to do, threaten them with nukes?
Right. And the other thing is why are we leaving everything up to France to negotiate? I mean,
because they're one of the few countries left that has any moral authority. We certainly don't.
Well, that's true.
Here's Bush saying, how can they invade a foreign country in the 21st century after we just invaded Afghanistan and Iraq?
I don't disagree with that and that point of view, except that Condoleezza Rice is a big Russian expert who also speaks Russian, right?
Yeah. So she completely missed this or completely blew it, just like she blew 9/11 when she was the national security advisor to the president. Yeah. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen, for the report.
Thank
Great
you.
Talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Up next, Larry Pratt, the director of Gun Owners of America.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
Well, there's going to be a whole lot of issues to make up this campaign year. And, of course, one of the ones that perennially has been a part of the campaign, particularly in rural America, but also in urban America, is the issue of guns, gun control. What are the, you know, where do rights begin and privileges, or rights end and privileges begin, and vice versa? You know, your right to swing your fist ends at the end of my nose, you know, the old cliche. How's this all going to play out? What about the, you know, a federal judge on Monday upheld a gun ban at Hartfield Jackson Atlanta International Airport, the biggest, busiest airport in the world, certainly busiest in the United States as well. Is this legal? Is this right? Larry Pratt is the executive director of Gun Owners of America. Gunowners.org is their website if you want to check it out. And Larry, welcome to the show.
Tom, thanks very much. Appreciate being with you.
Good to have you back with us. Why is it a bad thing for a national park or a college or an airport to say, sorry, we don't want any guns here?
Well, I guess if it were a good idea, then we should work for having a gun ban throughout the country. But the fact of the matter is that the places that tend to be the safest are the ones where guns are most readily available to people. And certainly
like the inside of a police department?
Those are not places where you find too many mass murders taking place. That's absolutely
right.
I'm
not sure what you're talking about. Unless you meant that facetiously.
When you've got a gun-free zone legally, it doesn't mean anything to a criminal. Certainly, one that's thinking of a crime that's much more horrendous than illegally possessing a firearm. And the malls and the schools that have been hit by multiple murderers are places where they were legally no-gun zones.
Right. Well, let's talk about college campuses. 18 to 24 is the age range, the peak age range, for binge drinking, for drug use, for mental health meltdowns, visits to psychiatrists, and for suicide. And college gun owners, there have been two different studies now, have shown that college gun owners are more likely than the average student, non-gun-owning students, to engage in binge drinking, need an alcoholic drink first thing in the morning, use cocaine or crack, be arrested for a DUI, vandalize property, or be injured in an alcohol-related fight. Do we really want these folks armed on our campuses, these kids?
I would say the answer is yes. You want especially those that have a concealed carry permit, because we do know that that group of people that have those permits, because they are registered, we can study them, and we know that the amount of crime that they commit is so much lower that we could only hope the rest of the population created as little a problem.
So it sounds like you're kind of taking my position that it's okay as long as it's regulated. It's like a car. This is a vehicle that's worth, you know, that's 6,000 pounds and can kill people, and so, of course, we want to make sure people are proficient and competent and responsible, and so everybody should have to have a license to carry a weapon.
Well, you could have made that assumption if I hadn't said, because we can study them, they're registered, and therefore we can study that group. I'm certainly not saying that I agree that they need to be licensed or permitted, and the places in the country where people don't need to have a license or a permit for a concealed carry firearm have among the very lowest of the murder rates in our country, of the whole population.
Well, they tend to be some of the most rural. I mean, when I lived in Vermont, you didn't, I think it's the only state in the country, in fact, where you can carry a concealed weapon without a license or a permit.
Alaska joined the list, and outside of incorporated areas, Montana as well, so okay, most of that state.
And yeah, and these are states that are by and large mostly rural. They're not areas where you have the high population density that seems to.
So what you're suggesting then is population density is more causative of crime than anything else. That would be the determining variable.
I would say probably actually poverty that's associated with high population density is
our murder rate went down during the Depression. So I don't think that's that connects at all. And one of the things that you see, for instance, if you look at Washington, D.C., which has its share of poverty, it's had a gun ban, and for practical purposes still does, a very high murder rate, some 35 per 100,000.
Well, generally crime went down during the Great Depression after 1933. Before 1933, there was an increase in crime. But when Franklin Roosevelt came in and said, okay, we're going to put people back to work, even if it means the government making jobs.
Well, once we got rid of prohibition, it helped a lot, too. Prohibition was something that was driving it up. But when you look at the city.
But my point is that when unemployment diminished, when employment went up, even though it was make work with the WPA and the WWW and the CCC and all these other things, that's when your crime went down. That's when murder went down. And which is, again, just making my point.
Crime was going down the whole time. It didn't start just because of the government make work programs. But if you look at Arlington, which is just like Washington, D.C., although it's smaller, the demographics are the same. It has a tenth of Washington's murder rate, but in Arlington, people are able to have firearms without any government.
But the demographics are not the same. Arlington is a wealthy suburb, and Washington, D.C. is mostly poor.
Arlington has as many wealthy areas proportionately as does Washington, but it also has as many poor areas as does Washington. Very similar. It's just like a little core sample that was taken out of Washington. So the idea that density of population somehow, or even poverty.
So are you suggesting that Washington, D.C.'s ban on guns is the only reason that Washington, D.C. had so many gun crimes?
Well, that was their experience. When they passed their gun law, that's when their murder rate began to really climb.
So now that the Supreme Court has struck that down, are their gun crimes dropping?
The court has stricken it down, but the city hasn't complied. Nobody has a license yet. Certainly nobody's going to be carrying. That wasn't even an issue before the court.
Larry, I've spent a fair amount of time in both Washington, D.C. and Arlington, and I don't see the similarities that you're characterizing.
The biggest difference in those two jurisdictions is the ability of people to be able to protect themselves. You go out to
I would say the biggest difference is income.
I don't think poverty makes people bad or crime prone, and I don't think high income makes them particularly prone to be good either. I just don't think that's what drives the human experience. But you do find
that when criminals think
they're going to have to pay a high price immediately, that I think is what affects them, because these are predators who think for the moment. They don't plan ahead. They're not like you and me. They're not willing to defer something until the future.
So let's just let all of them have guns.
Well, the criminals already have them, so we might as well let the rest of us be able to have access so that the playing field, as it were, has been made level.
So on a college campus or in an airport, you would prefer to have a lot of people with guns around?
Oh, absolutely, because if somebody is thinking of carrying out some kind of horrendous crime, I'd like to think that somebody can respond as they did at the Colorado Springs church, where a guy went in intent on mass murder. He'd killed four people on his way in, but he was down and out within 30 seconds because a team of members of the church were involved in a security operation that engaged him and took him down. Very different from what happened.
Right, they had an armed security force. But why is it then that countries that have, for all practical purposes, bans on handguns, like Canada, have a much lower handgun murder rate, a lower handgun suicide rate than we do?
You find,
or all the countries of Europe, for that matter.
Well, if you want to compare Europe, you can go to Switzerland, where every Swiss male under the age of, I think it's 45, must have a machine gun in his house. They have the lowest crime
rate military
of
rifle.
Just about That's... any country in the world. So
yeah, again, my point that first of all, those aren't handguns, and secondly,
they have a lot of handguns too, and machine guns are something that I don't think you're probably prepared to argue that Americans ought to be able to own.
But if you look at countries that have, you know, arguably as much poverty as the United States, as many minorities as the United States, you know, Spain, Italy, the southern parts of Europe, you don't see the handgun murder rates, because they're illegal, that you see here in the United States.
Well, you don't see it in a place like Mexico. It's true, because I think their poverty is such that they honestly can't buy a gun, but their knife murder rate is three times our handgun murder rate, and our handgun murder rate is probably 40-50% of all murders. So, you know, the Mexicans obviously have a desire to kill each other just as people in other countries do, and they find a way.
Yeah, well, I would suggest that we should be trying to figure out the cause. I don't think we even need to figure it out. I think by
the cause is the predatory nature of criminals, and we need to be able to deal with them effectively. Bang.
Yeah, okay. Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America, gunowners.org, the website. Thanks, Larry. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm sorry, I don't think it's that simple, but we'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I think we need a gun slinger. Gunslinger, there'll be justice all around. I think we need a gunslinger, somebody tough to tame this town. I think we need a gunslinger.
Take that! 21 minutes past the hour. Now, here's my take on this. The mentality, the idea that, oh, these are just predatory people. It's like it's genetic, right? Or it's just that's the way they're wired. We just have predators out there, and there's a growing number of them, and we need to kill them all. This was the theory that was put forth in the 1890s about the Italians, the Italian immigrants into the United States. There were books written about how they were genetically inclined to violence. In the 1850s and 60s, it was about the Irish. Oh, they're genetically inferior. They're genetically inclined to violence. It's like there has always, this goes all the way back to Darwin's cousin, Sir Francis Galton, writing about how the poor of England were genetically inclined to violence and poverty. I'm sorry, what you find is that when people have economic opportunity, when they have a job, they tend not to become entrepreneurs in areas that are outside the law. And that's an awful lot of what we're seeing. We're seeing people who are becoming entrepreneurs. They're running small businesses, essentially buying and selling drugs, which are illegal. And some of them are actually very sophisticated. And it's against the law. It's outside the law. You got guns. And then of course those who are not competent to do that, but can't find a job anywhere, are sticking people up. I mean, you know, so let's deal with the core issue here, which is poverty. You know, we have a society with the greatest riches and the greatest poverty in the industrialized world. And we wonder why we have problems like this, number one. And number two, I'd say, you know, let our students carry tasers and mace if they want on college campuses. You know, non-lethal means of self-defense. I'm all in favor of self-defense. But I just, you know, I respectfully disagree with Larry that having a whole bunch of college students, particularly the age when people are more inclined to be binge drinking, more inclined to be having mental psychiatric difficulties, mental breakdowns, more inclined to be suicidal, having them have easy access to a handgun, just grab the thing and walk out the door. I'm sorry, just creeps me out. So a lot on the table here today. You know, our McCain watch, by the way, particularly for our listeners in Pennsylvania, I just want to make a couple of points here on this. John McCain is running around Pennsylvania. He thinks it's going to be, you know, he's going to put the state into play. I don't know, maybe he's planning on picking Tom Ridge as his running mate or something like that. But he's talking about putting Pennsylvania into play. So how about a reality check? The DNC has put this out, just some pretty straightforward statistics. The Bush-McCain economic policies have put almost 70,000 Pennsylvanians out of work. For our listeners on WPTT in Pittsburgh and our other stations and other listeners all around Pennsylvania, trade deals Bush and McCain support have cost Pennsylvania more than 44,000 jobs. Over 1.2 million Pennsylvanians are without health insurance. That's 10% of the state. In just the first quarter of 2008 alone, 6,000 Pennsylvania homes received a foreclosure filing. NAFTA has lost over a million jobs for the United States, a net loss of 44,100 in Pennsylvania. Unemployment is up 26% in Pennsylvania under President Bush, comparing from when he was first appointed by the Supreme Court until today. Unemployment up 26%. So the McCain-Bush economic policies have been and will continue to be a disaster for Pennsylvania if Pennsylvania decides to go down that road. And I think it's just a very dangerous road for Pennsylvania to even be thinking about. But McCain's going to, you know, he's running around the state talking about how wonderful it is. You know, let's have more tax breaks for the rich. Let's have more trickle-down economics. Let's create more peons. Because that's all trickle-down economics does, is it creates a nation of peons. It's just very, very simple. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Frank in Los Angeles. Hey, Frank.
How you doing? You know, what irks me the most is when an economist or a guy that's a gun enthusiast tries to scare the public that the blue-collar crime is going to get you, when in fact white-collar crime is rampant and will steal all your money, cause you to lose your home. It wins hands down in the free economy that Milton Friedman said there's no such thing as a free market. As far as I'm concerned, I've seen it all controlled.
Yeah, and a gun is not going to help you when you've got a mortgage hustler, you know, who's not disclosing to you the terms of the agreement, or you've, you know, or somebody just, you know, ripping you out.
He's not using a gun. He's using a pen.
Yeah, a gun wouldn't have helped the victims of Ken Lay, for example.
Exactly. You know that. But these economists, like the freaking economics,
mm-hmm.
This guy blamed, he said that crime is going down because poor people are having abortions. He doesn't know what he's talking about, because crime goes down in good times and it goes up in bad times. White-collar crime goes up under Republicans because of deregulation and no oversight, and white-collar crime goes down under Democrats because they have regulation and oversight. So,
right, and in the absence of that white-collar crime, the middle class has a greater chance of growing and not being ripped off.
Exactly.
You know, spot on, Frank. Thanks a lot for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Speaking the Truth. The multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, for our video stream, free, live. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
We'll be right back.
shot someone. Cindy Sheehan better run. Better watch her liberal buns. Tell them that the war's not through. It probably put a hole in you.
Yeah, look out. Dick Cheney's on his way. 34 minutes past the hour. Well, it looks like the neocons, by the way, we've been talking throughout the last 3 hours about the neocons and their bizarre vision of the world and the Committee for the Present Danger and let's have a war with Russia and maybe that would be a great October surprise and all this kind of thing. Max Boots saying the Russian attack on Georgia, if left unchecked, could easily trigger more conflict in the future. Today, Georgia. Tomorrow, Ukraine. The day after, Estonia. And McCain advisor Gary Schmidt, another American Enterprise Institute fellow. It's also about resisting Russia's openly hegemonic designs on its neighbors, including Ukraine. A Wall Street Journal writing today, unless Russians see that there are costs for the Napoleonic expansionism, Georgia isn't likely to be his last stop. Krauthammer and Bolton went even farther, calling for the U.S. to actually intervene militarily, saying that Putin is trying to recreate the Soviet Union. John McCain hopping on with this harsh rhetoric. He told a Pennsylvania radio station today, quote, it's very clear that Russian ambitions are to restore the old Russian Empire, not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire, end quote. Well, it looks like Medvedev, you know what I'm talking about. The Russian president, Medvedev, has stopped the Russian activity, that they're, well, we'll see how this plays out. But frankly, I'm far more concerned about authoritarianism inside the Soviet Union and this ongoing battle for oil. I mean, this is really what it's all about. It's all about oil. And we need to understand the historic context of this, you know, how long this has gone on, where it's come from, how long it has been going on. And, in fact, here's just some audio on this. This is George Bush talking about our addiction to oil, right?
We got a real problem. America is addicted to oil. But I meant it because it's a true fact, and we've got to do something about it now.
And LBJ talking about... you know, oil, I believe this is the LBJ clip.
There's an Arab saying, the sands
no,
of
No, I'm sorry, this is
and I submit
Reagan.
To you, King Fahad, that if the sands of time give us any hint of the future, it is that in the days ahead, the friendship between the Saudi Arabian and American people will be a strong and vital force.
These are from the movie Blood for Oil, by the way, which is absolutely
Our
brilliant.
Our relations with Saudi Arabia have been long, close, and cordial. As the venerable Arab saying has it, our house is your house.
That's LBJ, and on it goes. I mean, this has always been our foreign policy, is ever since Roosevelt, is to protect oil, and that's what's continuing to go on. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw out a thought here, and it might serve well as a discussion on another day of to discuss it more fully. But, you know, we keep hearing about these situations where various organizations like Bear Stearns, and now they're talking about Citibank and Freddie Mac. These are too big to fail, they say.
Right.
They're just too big. Well, my question is this. Our system, as it's been explained to us in school and is often presented in the popular press, is a system where it's based on the idea that unless you're efficient and what have you, you will fail.
Right.
That's the whole premise of the system, and that all those that are efficient will succeed. My question is this. Don't we need some way of judging when organizations have begun to reach a level where they're too big to fail?
Yeah, it's called moral hazard, and yes, we had that system. It was called the Sherman Antitrust Act. We had that system. It was the Glass-Steagall Act, you know, that prevented banks from getting into the investment banking business. Over $400 million was given to Congress back in 1999, I believe. And during the last years of the Clinton administration to get Glass-Steagall rolled back. And it was rolled back by a piece of legislation that had Phil Graham's name in it. I mean, Phil Graham was the principal architect of rolling back Glass-Steagall and creating banks that were too big to fail. And Phil Graham is now, of course, the lead economic advisor to John McCain. Perhaps less than official now, but still, you know, right out there. So, yeah, absolutely. And we need to be breaking up these big banks. We need to be breaking up these big investment houses. It's time for, we need another Teddy Roosevelt. We absolutely need another Teddy Roosevelt, to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. We need another trust buster. Bob in Miami, let's stand and win. Hey, Bob.
Yeah,
hey, Bob.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Knowing that both Prescott Bush and Samuel Bush were Nazi sympathizers and, if not, members of the Nazi Party, Samuel Bush was involved in the businessman plot in 1933 to overthrow FDR and replace him with an Aryan fascist dictator. Do you think George Bush is going to carry on this evil family Nazi dream? And if so, how would he carry that out?
I don't know, Bob, but yeah, the Bush family apparently was involved in the attempt to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt. There have been a number of books written about it. Smedley Butler's book, War is a Racket, not specifically about that, but it's a brilliant. Butler's the guy who blew the whistle on it. Congress held one set of hearings, and at that point, Roosevelt asked them to stop because he didn't want anybody to get any more ideas. But whether George Bush, I guess the fear out there is that Bush isn't going to step down in January of 2009, and which would be 160 days, 9 hours, 44 minutes, and 14 minutes from now, according to my Bush Last Day clock, a gift from Tom Dwyer, one of our local automotive experts. And I just don't see it happening. But, you know, on the other hand, like I've said earlier, I don't think that it is the weird fringe of conspiracy theory to think that this administration encouraged Shaakashvili, the president of Georgia, to invade the breakaway republics on the Russian border that were viewed by Russia and most of the people living there as Russian, to invade them and try and take those territories back. I don't think it's conspiracy theory to say that we encouraged them to do that in order to provoke a confrontation that would amp up tensions that the Republicans think is going to help John McCain in the election. And frankly, A, I don't think it's going to help John McCain, and B, it is flirting with nuclear disaster. I mean, it's just, there's no other way to say it than that. Gloria in Los Angeles. Hey, Gloria.
Oh, happy. I'm very happy. I believe that Obama will not get in if he keeps on a course of playing ping pong with McCain, who comes out with a stupid thing and then he replies with another stupid thing. This is just a waste of time. The only way that Obama can get in, he has to stop saying what I'm going to give you, what I'm going to do. He can't even do anything with the mess that this country is in. What he has to do is reveal what has been going on. And you are the only host that I know that really goes into and knows all these neocons and how treacherous they are and how dangerous. And they have been running this country since Bush got in.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a copy of the Project for the New American Century. I mean, it's 120 pages. Mm-hmm. And, their tenets are advocating, wait, just one thing. A global missile defense systems renege on the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 72. Biological warfare, politically useful tool. Reject the UN. Control of space and cyberspace. I mean, these are criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it. I know it. But the country does not even know what PNAC stands for.
Yeah, by and large.
I'm going to give you the name of a site that I spotted called Truth Dig, T-R-U-T.
Oh, yeah, I'm very familiar with it.
Okay, and it's very credible because the guy who wrote this spot in there, Elliot Cohn, C-O-H-E-N, is brilliant. It was written on June 12, 2008. I wish you'd look that up because it shows you McCain's connections. He calls it the McCain's chilling project for America.
Yeah, I have read the article. In fact,
so do you agree that Obama has to make an offensive against McCain to show him up for what he is?
I'm really not sure, Gloria, because I'm not sure that most Americans realize how bad it's gotten. It was like that worked during the Great Depression for Franklin Roosevelt.
Get the book.
As I said, I haven't read the book. I've read the article, the excerpt, and I agree with you that we have a serious problem here. But how to educate the American public? It's a tough one.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Fighting for the common man and woman and the common good. Angie Hicks is with us. She is the founder of Angie's List. Every week we have one of our advertisers, an advertiser on our local affiliates, or sometimes a national advertiser in this case, and to give them a minute to talk about their product and a minute to talk about their experience advertising on Progressive Talk Radio in the hopes that if you listening are the owner of a small business or medium or even large business that would like to reach an activated, energized, enthusiastic audience at a reasonable price, that you will contact your local radio station and say, hey, you know, tell me about the advertising deals you guys have. So, Angie Hicks, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You started Angie's List, angieslist.com. I'm actually a member. Louise and I have used your services or the services of your, you know, folks who are also members of Angie's List a number of times.
Great.
Give us the one-minute pitch for Angie's List.
Sure. Angie's List is a place you can go to get the real scoop on local service companies. So if you're looking for anybody to help with home improvements around the house, car repair, pet care, even health care, we just started collecting ratings on health and health categories. You can check Angie's List to find out who other consumers in your area have used and been happy with. And the thing is, it's all generated by consumers. Companies don't pay to be listed or can't put themselves on the list.
Right, and it is so great. We had a kitchen counter that was installed by somebody that we didn't get from Angie's List. We took a referral from a friend, and it was a big mistake. This guy totally screwed everything up. And so we went to Angie's List to find somebody to fix the job, and he did a perfect job. I mean, it was just, you know, because they're all not only, you know, there's a filtering process. I mean, not only are good people there, but they also know that they're going to be rated.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, companies take it very seriously, take their ratings very seriously and really work to, you know, make sure that people are happy because they know they're being reported on.
Yep. So, Angie, what's your experience been advertising on Progressive Talk Radio?
It's worked extremely well for us. We've been advertising. We've been doing it all this summer. We've done it in previous years as well, and we always enjoy coming advertising and always get a really good response. So I encourage other people to take advantage of it as well.
Great. Thanks so much. Angie Hicks, she's the founder of Angie's List. Angie's List, A-N-G-I-E-S, list.com is the website. Check it out and use their services. Angie, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 52 minutes past the hour. And let's pick up a few phone calls here. Jeff in Orange County. Hey, Jeff, thanks for waiting on hold so long. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment earlier. You were talking about Rumsfeld and some of his colleagues trying to pass off information regarding stealth submarines.
Yeah, the Committee for the Present Danger. The best documentary on that, by the way, is Adam Curtis's "The Power of Nightmares." If you haven't seen it,
let me bring it a little more recent. Fox News this morning was reporting exactly that about Iran.
You're kidding.
Stealth submarines that can't be detected by anybody, may be made from old technology they purchased from the Soviet Union. They were trying to pass that off this morning with zero substantiation whatsoever. Obvious fear-mongering. I also wanted to comment then on your guest earlier. I find it a little humorous every time I hear somebody who is a proponent of unregulated gun ownership or more laxed gun ownership. They always want to jump down and say, well, you know, it's not the law-abiding people that are, you know, causing problems and so on. And then he goes on in his justification for some of this is that the people with their guns that are registered, you'll be able to study them and such. Well, again, these aren't the people that are causing problems.
Right.
So when you look at crimes that are being committed, whether a gun is registered or not, I mean, it's one of the most common things in any show about crime, file the serial numbers off. So do you think this guy is going to go in and register the gun and then file the serial numbers off or vice versa?
Right. There is a certain amount of circular logic there.
Oh, absolutely. If you actually reverse their logic in almost any argument they make, they fumble over themselves. It's pretty much, I believe, why they preface every comment they make with, have you ever heard of this book or this article? Have you ever read this, that, or the other thing?
Right.
So if you say yes, suddenly they'll skew their information slightly and or give a little bit of a little bit less background than perhaps they were going to.
Yeah.
I find it to be a little bit of a tactic that be is important.
Yeah, you know, and what I find, you know, I get it with the NRA. They are a business, you know, basically. It's the NRA is the lobbying arm of the weapons manufacturing industry. And, you know, I mean, they provide some good services. They've got an excellent program for training people in how to use, you know, firearms.
There's no doubt about it.
But they're basically a lobbying industry. So I understand why they would do things like hire spies. And, you know, I don't approve of it, but I understand it. What I don't get are the average person, you know, the average Joe out there who treats this like a religion. And you almost wonder if there's something very Freudian going on here.
Tom, I, like you, am from Michigan. I was born at Sparrow Hospital in Lansing.
So are two of my brothers.
I grew up, good stock comes out of that area, I think.
Louise was born at Sparrow Hospital, too, my wife.
Oh, outstanding. I moved to the UP and was raised in the UP. Born in Lansing, moved when I was one to the UP.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a gun. I mean, everybody has a gun. Everybody hunts. I used to bird hunt. I used to deer hunt. I got my buck my first morning of my first season and never deer hunted again because there is no real need to go out for sport and kill something. But more recently in the news, there was a shooting 2 weeks ago in Niagara, Wisconsin, by a registered gun owner with a registered weapon who just stepped out of the woods and gunned down the son and a couple of other schoolmates of a friend of mine who I graduated with from Kingsford High School.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it isn't just the crazies that are out there and unregistered guns and putting more guns in more young people's hands at universities with your point exactly on, Mark. Age where binge drinking is going on.
Yeah, Jeff, I've got to wrap it up. And also suicide. I mean, my very best friend all through high school was Clark Stinson. He went off and he joined the Army. He came home at Christmas, and he was so depressed about the Vietnam War and everything that was going on. He had a handgun. He put it in his mouth and blew the back of his brains all over the wall where we found him. And I don't believe that he would have committed suicide if he couldn't have just picked that gun up and done it. Anyhow, tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, the Endangered Species Act and why Bush is gutting it, and Jim Stark will be here about rescuing planet Earth. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.